welcome to the Doc Talk Podcast. I'm Patrick Campbell, Associate Editor with MD Magazine, and I will be your host for this edition of Doc Talk as we discuss allergies and asthma with Dr. Lakia Wright of Brigham and Women's Hospital. Welcome to the Doc Talk, Dr. Wright. Now, before we begin, if you could just give our listeners a little bit of background on who you are, a little bit of background on your experience, and any relevant disclosures you may have, then we can dive into our chat.
Hi, I'm Dr. Lakia Wright, and I'm a board-certified allergist. I'm also a practicing clinician, and I also serve as medical director of U.S. Clinical Affairs at Thermo Fisher Scientific.
All right, thank you for that, Dr. Wright. Now, just to start, I guess the first question would be, what is the current state of asthma in the United States? Are we seeing asthma rates continue to rise? And what would you point to as the main causes of this rise or potential decline, in your opinion?
Yeah, asthma is still a major public health issue. According to the CDC, there are about 32 million people that have been diagnosed with asthma at some point in their lifetime. And then about 22 million, but I've seen as high as 26 million, have current asthma, so active symptoms. And I would say that, you know, it's hard to say, but it looks like it may be on the rise, and it's hard to say because many people with asthma may remain undiagnosed or may not be diagnosed properly. So it's really important to, you know, sort of dive in a little bit deeper if your patient's talking about any sort of respiratory symptoms. And this is particularly important because, you know, they may not mention having wheeze because you can just have, you know, sort of shortness of breath and cough, and it could potentially be asthma. So we definitely want to keep that diagnosis on our radar. And it's, you know, it may be on the rise because of all these exposures that we're having, particularly when it comes to air pollution and the quality of our air.
All right, thank you for that. And now, backtracking a little bit to the end half of your question just there, or your answer, sorry. How is air quality affecting respiratory health in the U.S. right now? And what are some solutions to this? Obviously, the everyday patient can't not go outside and expose themselves sometimes. So what are some simple solutions that physicians can recommend to patients?
Yeah, so when it comes to air quality, it's sort of like two really big buckets that I like to think about it. There's air pollution, and then it's outdoor and indoor. So when it comes to outdoor air pollution, ozone being, you know, sort of a major contributor, and then also particulate matter. So that's when, like in the air, there are these small particles, and then there's like dust and fuel that sort of contribute to the composition of these small particles. And they can really serve as irritants for the lungs and really trigger asthma. And then when it comes to indoor air quality, you have things like, you know, cooking. Cooking produces a lot of fumes that can be an irritant. Also, tobacco smoke is really a major contributor to indoor air quality. So you always want to make sure you're asking questions about, you know, not only is the patient smoking, but is there anyone smoking in the home? And then there's even this this issue with third-hand exposure. So even if the person is not, if you're not directly exposed to smoke within your home, even if you have someone who does smoke, even having their clothes in the home, even though they may not be physically smoking, that can even trigger symptoms. So it's really important to get a detailed history. And then things like, you know, smoke from candles or fireplaces, that can contribute. And then the other part about air quality is actually things like allergens, and that can be a huge contributor to the air quality. So you have things like dust, mold, even pollens, because if you keep your windows open, the pollen can seep from outdoors, indoors, and it can be a major contributor to symptoms. And so what I'll say about allergens is that it's really important to, you know, take a good history to determine if your patients are having, you know, seasonal allergy symptoms, because again, asthma can be, you know, allergic, and actually majority of asthma is allergic, with kids estimated to have about 80% allergic asthma, as high as 80% to be allergic asthma. And then with adults, it's about estimated up to 60% of their asthma could be allergic. And so you want to take a good history. And then there also is blood testing available for common environmental allergens, dust mite, mold, pet dander, pollens, and so that can, you know, help to, along with the history, help to identify triggers, and then that way you can have a targeted treatment plan. And so when it comes to air quality, there are some, you know, simple solutions, like, for example, you know, it's hard to avoid the outdoors, but you can tell your patients to monitor, you know, because we often are listening to the weather or we look at it on our phones. They'll often mention, you know, what the ozone level is, or what, air pollution, like particulate matter and things like that, if it's high in the air. And then you want to minimize, you know, going outdoors during that, you know, time, so you can give your patients that tip. And then also they'll mention, like, the pollen levels. So if your patient is in fact allergic to pollen and you've, you know, confirmed it with a history and testing, then, you know, you can give them specific advice about seasons and which seasons in which they would want to try to minimize their exposure. Like, for example, in the spring we have trees, tree pollen that's high. Summer we have grasses, and right now in the fall we have, you know, weeds, particularly ragweed, that can be very high. And so you can tell them to try to minimize their exposure. And then as far as when they're coming from outdoors, indoors, you know, you should tell them to remove their clothing, because you can get some of that pollen on your clothing and it can still trigger symptoms. You should keep your windows closed, because again, that pollen can seep in. And then you should also shower before bed, because you want to, you know, remove all that, you know, pollen from you. And there are things like HEPA filters that can filter out the allergens from the air. And then there are things like, you know, for example, when I was talking about fumes, you know, you really want to remind them that they should have carbon monoxide detectors in their home, and they should be, you know, tested on a regular basis to make sure that they are in fact, you know, working. And then things like, you know, avoiding using like scented candles or air fresheners. That would, all of these things would help to improve the air quality. And are great tips for patients. Oh, and one more that I forgot. If your patient lives in sort of like a humid environment, and this particularly if they have perhaps like a basement apartment, or if they just like have a lot of their apartment may be humid, then they can get a dehumidifier as well. So all these tips could help improve the air quality for your patient.
Okay, and now sort of staying on topic of climate and changing seasons, often I'm sure for allergy and immunologists and asthma specialists, it's like many specialties of medicine where you don't often see patients until after there's been a serious event that occurs. What are some ways that physicians can better connect or inform patients on the impact of changing seasons or the impact of changing weather on allergies and asthma, and what may or may not constitute a serious event for them?
Yeah, so I think that going through the history in detail and trying to identify those triggers and trying to, you know, sort of understand some people with their asthma, they can sort of predict when it would flare. So for example, patients, you know, we're in asthma peak week. And so if you get a good history that would suggest that your patient really suffers during peak week, and they're typically having asthma attacks, and perhaps preventatively you can, you know, sort of increase their medications, make sure that you go over all those tips that I mentioned about how to reduce their exposure. You can make sure that you've, you know, tested them for environmental allergens if their history suggests that. And because all of these things would help to try to help the patient understand, you know, when the asthma could get really bad. And I'm a big fan of providing asthma action plans. And so the way that that will work is they would know when they're in the danger zone. So for example, if they're using their short acting inhaler, albuterol, you know, frequently, then they know that they're in the danger zone. And depending on how you structure the asthma plan, they if they're using it a lot, then they may need to go up on their inhaler, or if it's a really bad attack, they may need to go to the, you know, ER, but you can put all of this in a plan, or they may need to call you. And so you can structure this in the plan and have them post it on their refrigerator so that they can understand, you know, for example, if they have symptoms two or more times in a week, we say it's the rule of two or more times in a week during the day, or two or more times at night in a month. Those are all alarm symptoms that the asthma may not be well controlled. In addition to, you know, getting a history and trying to understand, is there a pattern to when they're having asthma attacks? And then that can help, you know, define these serious events and try to get ahead of a serious event. And I also like giving my patients a peak flow so they can breathe into it when they're feeling good, and then breathe into it, you know, when they're in the office, so that they can get a sense of, you know, what is my lung function? How well am I breathing? Because sometimes it can be hard for them to articulate when the symptoms are getting bad. But then if they have something like a tube, like a peak flow that they're breathing into, and actually getting a number, then that can make it more objective. And it's more about empowering the patient to understand really when they're getting into the danger zone. And I think, you know, getting a good history, identifying those triggers, you know, combining it with, you know, testing for allergens, if you're getting the medical history that allergens may be a trigger, and then making sure that you have that asthma action plan and peak flow. And then one thing that physicians often want to make sure, we want to make sure that physicians are actually monitoring the lung function too. I mentioned peak flow, but there's also spirometry. It is recommended at least annually in asthmatics, and some people will do it even, you know, more frequently depending on the patient's symptoms. And so I think a combination of all of those, you know, all of those elements can be combined into asthma action plan. And then when you're seeing the patient in the office, having an asthma control test, and that's available online, the asthma control test can make things very objective, because sometimes patients do have a hard time articulating their symptoms. But then if they have a questionnaire that's been well validated in front of them, you know, you can tell controlled or not. You know, 18 or higher would suggest that, you know, their asthma is controlled, and then if it's less, then it's likely that their asthma isn't controlled. So it's a way to quantify their symptoms and then take an action based on the asthma control test in a more objective way.
All right, thank you for that. And now, just lastly, you had a recent approval for a biologic indicated for pediatric patients between the ages of 6 and 11 with severe eosinophilic asthma. Do you think we'll continue to see biologics and other individualized treatments reach younger and younger asthmatic populations?
I think that we will see, it's likely that we will see the use see more biologics being approved for children. And I think that's because children are twice as likely as adults to have asthma. And some of those children with asthma, it can be moderate to severe, and they don't do as well. Some children will not do as well with, you know, conventional therapies like inhaled steroids. And you really want to try to minimize putting children on, you know, chronic steroids or giving them, you know, multiple bursts of steroids. And so that's where, you know, biologics fit in, but it's actually, you know, like a smaller portion of children with asthma that would actually need it. And it is very targeted therapy, but it's targeted for those that are really moderate to severe, and other conventional treatments have not worked. And so typically you'll see it approved around age six, because that's when, you know, it's, you know, the asthma sort of, I'll say it sort of declares itself. It's likely that, you know, based on the history, that the diagnosis of asthma, you know, is made. I mean, children can have some wheeze, and they can have wheeze with viral illness, and they can be diagnosed with asthma younger, but, you know, at age six or higher, it's more, you know, clear if they're going to sort of have the asthma on a more chronic basis, and if they're exhibiting sort of moderate to severe severity in their asthma, then you know, if the asthma isn't well controlled, then a biologic may be appropriate. But the thing about biologics is that it is, while it may help to control your asthma, you have to, you know, be very selective in the one that you're choosing, because it is targeted therapy. So for example, with omalizumab, you know, you have to have a total IG level that's in a certain range, and then the patient has to have demonstrate that they have a year-round allergy to something like dust mites or you know, pet dander, something that's year-round. And so and you would investigate that through you know, the patient's history and blood testing with a total IgE level and the specific IgE to the perennial allergen. And so you want to be very selective about, you know, which patient would be appropriate for a biologic, because it is sort of altering their immune system. And we don't know all of the long-term consequences of that. And so that's why we want to be selective about choosing the patients and choosing them appropriately, and using the more conventional therapies first. And then when those do not work, then we turn to the biologics. So it's much more, you know, selective and targeted based on, you know, biomarkers and blood, you know, the blood testing to see if that patient is eligible for that particular biologic. But as we use more and more biologics, we'll understand the long-term consequences and the safety profile, you know, better. So I think it is, you know, definitely a promising therapy, but it's very selective in the patients that, you know, it's a very selective population in which, you know, we should use it for children with really moderate to severe asthma that have failed traditional therapy.
Okay, that was about it on my questions. Was there anything else you wanted to add related to anything we touched on today?
If a good resource for allergy information is allergyinsider.com, and we have a lot of educational information on our website about, you know, asthma and allergies, so that is also a good resource.
All right. Thank you once again, Dr. Wright, for taking part in our Doc Talk podcast this week. And thank you to all of our listeners for tuning in. For the latest in allergy and asthma news, be sure to head to mdmagazine.com. Thanks for listening.